Standards of Conduct and Spiritual Freedom. We're a bit into the chapter now, written in May or June of 1915, and then rewritten in 1932 or so, and then again touched upon in the 1940s, early 1940s. At this point, Sri Aurobindo has not started writing his material on social philosophy in the Arya when he first takes this up. The ideal of human unity would come a few months later. But we do have here some revisions in what he wrote back in 1915. So a bit of an expansion on the topic. He begins this section. There are four main standards of human conduct that make an ascending scale. The first is personal need, preference, and desire. The second is the law and good of the collectivity. The third is an ideal ethic. The last is the highest divine law of the nature. Man starts on the long career of his evolution, with only the first two of these four to enlighten and lead him, for they constitute the law of his animal and vital existence, and it is as the vital and physical animal man that he begins his progress. The true business of man upon earth is to express in the type of humanity a growing image of the divine. Whether knowingly or unknowingly, it is to this end that nature is working in him under the thick veil of her inner and outer processes. But the material or animal man is ignorant of the inner aim of life. He knows only its needs and its desires, and he has, necessarily, no other guide to what is required of him than his own perception of need and his own stirrings and pointings of desire. To satisfy his physical and vital demands and necessities before all things else and in the next rank, whatever emotional or mental cravings or imaginations or dynamic notions rise in him must be the first natural rule of his conduct. The sole balancing or overpowering law that can modify or contradict this pressing natural claim is the demand put on him by the ideas, needs, and desires of his family, community, or tribe, the herd, the pack, of which he is a member. So that classic antinomy in sociology between the individual and the collectivity. The person and the village. And you can see how easily this is platted over his general idea of evolution, that the physical and the vital appertains to the early organization of human life. But then, as one develops, an ethic arises. As mentality progresses, intellectuality begins to impose its own order, its own pursuit and perception of truth. But Sri Aurobindo has already suggested that there is a divine law, a different dharma, not the dharma that is mind-born, imposing itself on the antinomy of individual and collectivity, but something else that should guide and rule. So he continues, if man could live to himself, and this he could only do if the development of the individual were the sole object of the divine in the world, this second law would not at all need to come into operation. But all existence proceeds by the mutual action and reaction of the whole and the parts, the need for each other of the constituents and the thing constituted, the interdependence of the group and the individuals of the group. In the language of Indian philosophy, the divine manifests himself always in the double form of the separative and the collective being, Vyashti, Samashti, and it means that literally, individuality and collectivity. So this idea of the individual being abstract and apart from the collectivity, you'll remember that Sri Aurobindo does not accept, even in his philosophic notions as expressed in the Life Divine, that even there he has described the individual as an aspect of the all, of the whole. If there is a divine person, this divine person is not abstracted from the all either, but constitutes the all within itself. And true individuality exists, but it exists in the context of the whole. There is this fictional idea of an ego living apart. I am a rock. I am an island. That does not exist. As John Donne said again, I am a member of the whole. No man is an island entire unto himself. Each man is a part of the whole. This idea that the individual must live interdependently with larger society is also part of Immanuel Kant's philosophy, that he recognizes that there is the unsociable sociableness of the human. He wants to be by himself. His ego, his desires make him want to fend for himself, but he is compelled into contact with a larger social context and must deal with it, whether he wants to or no. So Sri Aurobindo is writing in this larger context of social philosophy. Man, pressing after the growth of his separate individuality and its fullness and freedom, is unable to satisfy even his own personal needs and desires except in conjunction with other men. He is a whole in himself and yet incomplete without others. This obligation englobes his personal law of conduct in a group law, which arises from the formation of a lasting group entity with a collective mind and life of its own, to which his own embodied mind and life are subordinated as a transitory unit. And yet, there is something in him, immortal and free, not bound to this group body, which outlasts his own embodied existence, but cannot outlast or claim to chain by its law his eternal spirit. So that's true. There is something in the individual which can always reclaim its transcendent nature. But what Sri Aurobindo does not introduce here when he talks about the group mind and the group life or the group body is the possibility of a group soul, of a larger collective unity. Now, of course, he writes about it towards the end of The Life Divine beautifully, in a way that compels you to want to try to live such a life, that justifies the idea of an ashram which would bring that into being so that the awakened individual would know his soul and live more from the soul than from the ego and from desire patterns, and would also help through his or her personal realization the formation of a group soul, which would then, in a sense, sustain and carry all members forward. There would be a sense of commonality, of oneness, of a shared felicity that otherwise would be absent from human life. You see the other and you recognize kinship. You recognize solidarity. You don't have to seek for it. The intra-psychic question does not rise. You are part of each other's inner being, you see. So this is the idea that actuates an ashram as it comes into fleshly being, into vital being, becomes aware of itself in the mind, but then pushes into the soul frontier. This is the thing, you see, that's coincident to the transformation of humanity, when we have not only an awakened individual, but an awakened group life, living not only from the soul personally, having found the divine here, but having found the divine all in a particular group. And then as it looks out, it stretches boundlessly everywhere. It sees only the oneness of nature, no division, just a single truth. In the all, as in the one who looks from the personal perspective. In itself, this seemingly larger and overriding law is no more than an extension of the vital and animal principle that governs the individual elementary man. It is the law of the pack or herd. The individual identifies partially his life with the life of a certain number of other individuals with whom he is associated by birth, choice, or circumstance. The adventitious group. And since the existence of the group is necessary for his own existence and satisfaction in time, if not from the first, its preservation, the fulfillment of its needs, and the satisfaction of its collective notions, desires, habits of living, without which it would not hold together, must come to take a primary place. The satisfaction of personal idea and feeling, need and desire, propensity and habit, has to be constantly subordinated by the necessity of the situation, and not from any moral or altruistic motive, to the satisfaction of the ideas and feelings, needs and desires, propensities and habits, not of this or that other individual or number of individuals, but of the society as a whole. This social need is the obscure matrix of morality and of man's ethical impulse. How we behave with others, how we align our conduct with theirs, because the group life is the most important. And this is true up until the centuries immediately preceding ours, where the idea of the individual begins to flourish. It is not actually known that in any primitive times, man lived to himself or with only his mate, as do some of the animals. All record of him shows him to us as a social animal, not an isolated body and spirit. And this has been emphasized now in modern anthropology. The law of the pack has always overridden his individual law of self-development. He seems always to have been born, to have lived, to have been formed as a unit in a mass. But logically and naturally, from the psychological viewpoint, the law of personal need and desire is primary. The social law comes in as a secondary and usurping power. So when we begin to become aware of our own being, our own needs, we want to place ourselves first and push society's demands a little distant. Man has in him two distinct master impulses, the individualistic and the communal, a personal life and a social life, a personal motive of conduct and a social motive of conduct. The possibility of their opposition and the attempt to find their equation lie at the very roots of human civilization and persist in other figures when he has passed beyond the vital animal into a highly individualized mental and spiritual progress. So you can recall the context of his political work a decade or so before he begins writing this, and how he strove to convince his fellow Indians to bend their personal needs to the demands of a larger need, a social need, to oust the British from political domination of India, which had been subjugated, which, when the British came, was the richest country upon earth, and when the British eventually left, was among the poorest. So he certainly knew what it took to build commonalty, to build political force, to build a sense of oneness. Sri Aurobindo awakened India to the possibility of political freedom more than many of those who were complacent and wanted to work more or less in alignment with the British. He demanded freedom for his country. The existence of a social law external to the individual is at different times a considerable advantage and a heavy disadvantage to the development of the divine in man. It is an advantage at first when man is crude and incapable of self-control and self-finding, because it erects a power other than that of his personal egoism, through which that egoism may be induced or compelled to moderate its savage demands, to discipline its irrational and often violent movements, and even to lose itself sometimes in a larger and less personal egoism. It is a disadvantage to the adult spirit, ready to transcend the human formula, because it is an external standard which seeks to impose itself on him from outside. And the condition of his perfection is that he shall grow from within and in an increasing freedom, not by the suppression, but by the transcendence of his perfected individuality. Not any longer by a law imposed on him that trains and disciplines his members, but by the soul from within breaking through all previous forms to possess with its light and transmute his members. So, a beautiful passage, and of course it is directly applicable to the individual living in the ashram life. But it also recalls something that we meet in the next paragraph as well, something that M.P. Pundit summarized when looking at Sri Aurobindo's social philosophy. He noted that the French Revolution failed because while it imparted individual liberty, individual freedom, it denied equality. The Bolshevik Revolution failed because while it provided equality, it denied liberty. It is only when the third element, fraternity, emerges that we can balance the need, the demand of the individual with the need, the demand of society. Liberty, equality, fraternity, that soulhood that unites us all, must become part of the human picture. And towards that, humanity is evolving. We'll turn the page and we'll go into this next section as well. I think Sri Aurobindo essayed that idea in more than one place, but you can find it in an early article that he wrote back in the 1890s, I think it was in the 1890s, called Epistles from Abroad. In the conflict of the claims of society with the claims of the individual, two ideal and absolute solutions confront one another. There is the demand of the group that the individual should subordinate himself more or less completely, or even lose his independent existence in the community. The smaller must be immolated or self-offered to the larger unit. He must accept the need of the society as his own need, the desire of the society as his own desire. He must live not for himself, but for the tribe, clan, commune, or nation of which he is a member. The ideal and absolute solution from the individual's standpoint would be a society that existed not for itself, for its all-overriding collective purpose, but for the good of the individual and his fulfillment, for the greater and more perfect life of all its members. Representing as far as possible his best self and helping him to realize it would respect the freedom of each of its members and maintain itself not by law and force, but by the free and spontaneous consent of its constituent persons. An ideal society of either kind does not exist anywhere, and would be most difficult to create, more difficult still to keep in precarious existence so long as individual man clings to his egoism as the primary motive of existence. A general but not complete domination of the society over the individual is the easier way, and it is the system that nature from the first instinctively adopts and keeps in equilibrium by rigorous law, compelling custom, and a careful indoctrination of the still subservient and ill-developed intelligence of the human creature. In primitive societies, the individual life is submitted to rigid and immobile communal custom and rule. This is the ancient and would-be eternal law of the human pack that tries always to masquerade as the everlasting decree of the imperishable, Esha Dharmaha Sanatanaha, which means literally, this is the eternal law. And by the way, that's from the Manusmriti, fourth chapter, 138 is the verse. It says, speak truth that is sweet. Do not speak a truth that is not sweet. Do not lie to please. This is eternal dharma. Satyama Priyam. And the ideal is not dead in the human mind. The most recent trend of human progress is to establish an enlarged and sumptuous edition of this ancient turn of collective living towards the enslavement of the human spirit. He refers obviously to communism. And you may remember that I think in his talks, evening talks, that he had made note that it was ironic that he had placed a great deal of superconscient force upon the possibility of the collective ideal coming forward in the midst of the Russian Revolution. Well, it didn't take, and as it took its eventual form, it had rather ironic fruit, which he lamented. He had his periods of the collective, and he had his periods of the individual, and frankly, he saw through both. He continues. There is here a serious danger to the integral development of a greater truth upon earth and a greater life. For the desires and free seekings of the individual, however egoistic, however false or perverted they may be in their immediate form, contain in their obscure shell the seed of a development necessary to the whole. His searchings and stumblings have behind them a force that has to be kept and transmuted into the image of the divine ideal. So, just as he sees the divine personhood hiding behind the mask of the human ego, he sees that ultimately we must throw off the ego and reveal the true person inside. Just so here too, what seems to be the demand of the limited individual has behind it an articulating power of the divine consciousness that is reaching for a goal beyond the egoism, beyond the form of the desire, beyond the limitation. So sometimes that individual has to go forward, and sometimes that individual goes forward with a force of a gathered nature, as a Vibhuti, as a Napoleon, who has to strike and smash and pursue a particular grand desire to make a goal on the side of an evolving humanity. Individualism, pardon me, that force needs to be enlightened and trained, but must not be suppressed or harnessed exclusively to society's heavy cartwheels. Individualism is as necessary to the final perfection as the power behind the group spirit. The stifling of the individual may well be the stifling of the God in man. And in the present balance of humanity, there is seldom any real danger of exaggerated individualism breaking up the social integer. There is continually a danger that the exaggerated pressure of the social mass, by its heavy, unenlightened mechanical weight, may suppress or unduly discourage the free development of the individual spirit. For man in the individual can be more easily enlightened, conscious, open to clear influences. Man in the mass is still obscure, half conscious, ruled by universal forces that escape its mastery and its knowledge. Against this danger of suppression and immobilization, nature in the individual reacts. It may react by an isolated resistance, ranging from the instinctive and brutal revolt of the criminal to the complete negation of the solitary and ascetic. It may react by the assertion of an individualistic trend in the social idea, may impose it on the mass consciousness and establish a compromise between the individual and the social demand. But a compromise is not a solution. It only salves over the difficulty, and in the end, increases the complexity of the problem and multiplies its issues. A new principle has to be called in, other and higher than the two conflicting instincts, and powerful at once to override and to reconcile them. Above the natural individual law, which sets up as our one standard of conduct, the satisfaction of our individual needs, preferences, and desires, and the natural communal law, which sets up as a superior standard the satisfaction of the needs, preferences, and desires of the community as a whole, there had to arise the notion of an ideal moral law which is not the satisfaction of need and desire, but controls and even coerces or annuls them in the interests of an ideal order that is not animal, not vital and physical, but mental. A creation of the mind's seeking for light and knowledge and right rule and right movement and true order. The moment this notion becomes powerful in man, he begins to escape from the engrossing vital and material into the mental life. He climbs from the first to the second degree of the threefold ascent of nature. His needs and desires themselves are touched with a more elevated light of purpose, and the mental need, the aesthetic, intellectual, and emotional desire begin to predominate over the demand of the physical and vital nature. And so we arrive at the age of enlightenment. So Sri Aurobindo is seeing an ascent of humanity ranging from ancient times up to the present, where rationality, where intellectuality, where the blossoming of mind leads us to the doors of the spirit. So anyway, such comes the standards of conduct which mold our lives. We hope from a higher intellectual source, and we will be going in upcoming weeks, let us say, beyond mind. So I think we can put a bookmark there, and we'll continue next week. Now, this passage for tonight from Savitri is about these difficult doings, so may not be as sublime as some that you've been accustomed to hearing of late, but I think it's relevant to what we've been reading tonight. This is from Book 2, The Book of the Traveler of the Worlds, Canto 4, The Kingdoms of the Little Life, and it begins on page 144. The narrow horizon of their days was filled with things and creatures that could help and hurt. The world's values hung upon their little self. Isolated, cramped, and the vast unknown, to save their small lives from surrounding death, they made a tiny circle of defense against the siege of the huge universe. They preyed upon the world and were its prey, but never dreamed to conquer and be free. Obeying the world power's hints and firm taboos, a scanty part they drew from her rich store. There was no conscious code and no life plan. The patterns of thinking of a little group fixed a traditional behavior's law. Ignorant of soul, save as a wraith within, tied to a mechanism of unchanging lives and to a dull usual sense and feelings beat, they turned in grooves of animal desire. In walls of stone fenced round, they worked and warred, did by abandoned selfishness a small good, or wrought a dreadful wrong and cruel pain on sentient lives, and thought they did no ill. Ardent from the sack of happy, peaceful homes, and gorged with slaughter, plunder, rape, and fire, they made of human selves their helpless prey, a drove of captives led to lifelong woe, or torture, a spectacle made and holiday, mocking or thrilled by their torn victims' pangs, admiring themselves as titans and as gods. Proudly they sang their high and glorious deeds and praised their victory and their splendid force. An animal in the instinctive herd, pushed by life impulses, forced by common needs, each in his own kind saw his ego's glass. All served the aim and action of the pack. Those like himself, by blood or custom kin, to him were parts of his life, his adjunct selves, his personal nebula's constituent stars, satellite companions of his solar eye. A master of his life's environment, a leader of a huddled human mass herding for safety on a dangerous earth, he gathered them round him as if minor powers to make a common front against the world, or weak and sole on an indifferent earth as a fortress for his undefended heart, or else to heal his body's loneliness. In others than his kind, he sensed a foe, an alien unlike force to shun and fear, a stranger and adversary to hate and slay. Or he lived as lives the solitary brute. At war with all, he bore his single fate. Absorbed in the present act, the fleeting days, none thought to look beyond the hour's gains, or dreamed to make this earth a fairer world, or felt some touch, divine surprise his heart. The gladness that the fugitive moment gave, the desire grasped, the bliss, the experience won, movement and speed and strength were joy enough, and bodily longing shared, and quarrel and play, and tears and laughter, and the need called love. In war and clasp, these life wants joined the all-life, wrestlings of a divided unity, inflicting mutual grief and happiness, in ignorance of the self forever one. Namaste. Jai Ma.